If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tom Watson, who did all he could to bring Tony Blair down, is now, you know, the hero of the Blairite resistance.
This is Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Oliver Wiseman, CapEx's editor. Tony Blair was arguably the most electorally successful Prime Minister of recent British history. And yet, if you ask British voters today what they think of the man behind New Labour, the answer is not exactly an enthusiastic thumbs up. Just 22% think Blair did a good job. 49% think he did a bad job in number 10. Nowhere is the repudiation of Blair clearer than at the top of the Labour Party today. For those with their hands on the reins, Blairite is about the worst insult going, and it's impossible to understand the rise of Corbyn without appreciating Blair's legacy. My guest this week is someone who takes a very different view of Blair. John Rentoul is the Independent's chief political commentator who, unusually for a Westminster journalist, also teaches a course on Tony Blair with John Davis at King's College London. Davis and Rentoul have just published a book on the Blair government, aptly titled Heroes or Villains. They make generous use of fascinating first-hand testimony to paint a more flattering portrait of New Labour than many on both the left and the right would agree with. For this week's episode of Free Exchange, I spoke to John Rentoul about all things Blair. What were his biggest achievements? How much of the blame does he deserve for our contemporary political problems? Why was his relationship with Gordon Brown quite so dysfunctional? And how, ultimately, will history judge him? I started by asking John what he thinks makes Tony Blair such a fascinating figure.
Oh, well, I think he was a very interesting Prime Minister. I mean, I originally wrote the biography of him because I was filming him for the BBC, and this was before he was leader. This is after the 1992 election, and I just thought he was a very interesting politician. I thought he had just then acquired this unnatural ability to communicate on television, which has always been one of his most striking qualities. But I thought, you know, his politics were also interesting. I thought he had interesting things to say about modernising the Labour Party and, you know, creating a mass membership outward-looking party. A lot of that turned out not to be very relevant in the long run. But, you know, the more I wrote about him, the more interesting he seemed. And, you know, obviously that led to writing a pre-prime ministerial biography and then a post-prime ministerial biography, or while he was prime minister. And then when he stepped down, I thought he was an interesting subject for contemporary history. And so we carried on. And the book is a product of the course.
Yeah, so why don't you explain the kind of the project more broadly, not just the book, because I mean, the book is filled with anecdotes and stuff from people, in, you know, very, very senior people, including Blair. But you know, you basically run this course where you bring in senior figures from the New Labour government, and do you want to just talk through?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was inspired by Peter Hennessy, the doyen of contemporary history, who said that, you know, just imagine after the end of the Attlee government, if we had the chance to sit all the cabinet ministers and senior civil servants down and talk to them about that government, how much better informed history would have been. And that was our thinking, that, you know, ultra contemporary history is something that you can attempt, and that's because we thought that the Blair government was so interesting with what it was trying to achieve, that we thought it was an appropriate subject for historical study, even, you know, that we were talking about 18 months after he had stepped down as prime minister, but we didn't think that was an obstacle to using the sort of techniques of historical inquiry.
So if newspapers are a first draft, this is a sort of second draft of history, is that the kind of...
Yes, and I think the book is probably getting on towards third or fourth draft, but, you know, it's a constant process, isn't it, history, of rewriting, reassessing, and reevaluating, and we're hoping to contribute to that process because, I mean, mainly because we felt that the reputation of the Blair government was not being fairly represented, that it had got into this sort of feedback loop between public opinion and the media that was constantly driving its reputation downwards, which in a way which we thought was completely ahistorical and didn't reflect the complexities of that government.
Well, then, so let's talk about the sort of stereotype you're pushing against, really. The book's called Heroes and Villains, and Heroes or Villains, rather. And, you know, Blairite is a sort of insult in the Labour Party at the moment, which is surprising given that, well, in many ways it's surprising given that Tony Blair is the most successful Labour politician of recent history.
Yeah.
So, you know, explain to me your account of why he is quite so unpopular, specifically among Labour people.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously a lot of it comes down to the Iraq War, which is completely understandable. People felt very strongly about it. In my view, unreasonable, you know, their strong feelings tipped into unreasonable arguments and unreasonable language about, you know, warmonger and war criminal, which... You know, you can understand why that should be a big negative, but it shouldn't be allowed to obscure the record of what was, you know, a really successful reforming social democratic government that had actually achieved quite a lot, and from which, you know, the Labour Party needs to learn, and, you know, it's in danger of learning all the wrong lessons, which is, you know, whatever Blair did, do the opposite.
And so what do you see? I mean, on the positive side of the ledger, you know, what do you see as the big achievements, the big achievements of the Blair government?
Well, I mean, they're too numerous to list. I mean, you know, I remember being interviewed after Tony Blair stepped down by interviewers who were basically saying, you know, Tony Blair, what a terrible man, what a terrible government. And then, you know, all I would say, I mean, I would just have to say, well, what about Northern Ireland? And then, well, they'd say, yeah, well, yes, there is that. And then it was like, what did the Romans ever do for us? I mean, you could just go through the list. You know, he actually transformed the public services in this country. I mean, the NHS, people just do not remember how underfunded and difficult things were in the NHS in 1997. Schools, likewise. Criminal justice... You know, maybe not so dramatic, but I mean, crime continued to fall, and I think the sort of there were more intangible sort of benefits, such as equal rights for gay people and women, you know, civil partnerships, better representation for women, better equality laws all round. That just made this country a better and more pleasant place. And the public investment transformed the whole country. I mean, I think it's just a better country at the end of 10, 13 years of whether you regard Gordon Brown as New Labour or not, 10 or 13 years of Labour government.
The other, I mean, Iraq, you said, is obviously the big focus of lots of the criticism, but... You can make an argument, and I think indeed you acknowledge this in the book, that if you look at what's happened in politics, if you stop the clock when Tony Blair leaves number 10 and lists the achievements, as you say, there's a long and impressive list there.
Yeah.
But equally, if you fast forward to the present day, you can see the seeds of our current political and arguably economic problems in a lot of you know, as Blair's legacy too.
So yes.
You know, whether that's the question of Europe, whether that's the financial crisis, general trust in politicians. I mean, that's a relate. That's you can't disentangle that from Iraq and other things, I think. So, you know, do you sort of, how much of that blame is fair and how much of it is unfair, do you think?
Well, that is the very interesting question. That is the question of historical revisionism. I mean, that's the reason why, you know, obviously there are limitations to doing ultra-contemporary history. I mean, when we started teaching this course in 2008, the, you know, Lehman Brothers had only just gone bust, and, you know, the scale of the financial crisis was not apparent. And obviously, yes, you need a lot of time to consider what the sort of long-term implications of a government are. And that does complicate the picture. And certainly, you know, a lot of those things have turned out to be fairly negative in that, you know, the golden economic record of those 10 years of Tony Blair turned out to be rather quickly tarnished. Although you could say that was just the business cycle reasserting itself, and that, you know, it was still a reasonable performance, actually comparatively, you know, comparing with other countries and comparing with previous British governments, that was still a very good period, even after the financial crash, even after that correction.
Part of it's surely just sort of rhetorical overreach. I mean, to claim to have ended boom and bust, as Brown did, and I think Blair did as well.
I'm afraid Blair used the phrase as well.
It's obviously a really stupid thing to do, isn't it?
It was very, very foolish. But in a way, that was all part of one of the biggest sort of underlying problems of the whole Blair government, was that expectations were too high in 1997. I mean, everyone expected, because Tony Blair had won such a huge victory, that there would be, you know, miraculous consequences as a result, and everybody who voted with hope in their hearts would get what they wanted. And obviously that's not possible. And so the disappointment when it came, I think was so much more intense. And I think that's, we're still living with the unfolding of that.
Right. Well, let's talk about the relationship at the heart of all of this, which is between Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. It's obviously significant that your book is about the Blair government, not New Labour. So the story ends in 2007. So firstly, what's the logic behind that choice? I mean, do you see them as distinct phases of government rather than a single New Labour project?
Well, yes. I mean, we thought that, you know, in the sort of individual versus great forces view of history, Tony Blair was, as an individual, you know, a most exceptional and an interesting leader, and so we decided to focus on him. But of course, you can't really take away from the what he called the plus three years of Gordon Brown afterwards. And so, you know, actually the border isn't very clear cut in the book. I mean, we do have to look at what follows. But we were very clear that, you know, one way of looking at the Blair government was as a coalition between him and the Brownites. And so, you know, to an extent, we were looking at the period when, you know, one part of that coalition was in government, in the lead role. And but then it did carry on with the junior coalition partner, as it were, continuing for another 3 years.
Yeah, and you actually say that if you compare it to the Conservative Lib Dem coalition, it was actually sort of much less functional and much more unhappy than the exactly because the two separate parties can kind of air their grievances publicly, whereas Brown and Blair had to pretend to be
exactly. I mean, that was one of the most striking things that civil servants said after 2010 was how much easier it was to manage relations between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats compared with managing Blairites versus Brownites, who are notionally in the same party, which, you know, is I thought it was just an interesting way of looking at that government, but it also allows us to make the point that, you know, Tony Blair was never you know, quite as preeminent and as all-powerful as he sometimes presented himself as being.
And one of the fascinating things I'm reminded of reading the book is how the question of succession and is there from day one. In fact, it's there from before day one.
Yes.
So it's amazing that, you know, when with hindsight you see this as a, you know, of course Tony Blair, 10 years in power, and Gordon Brown's sort of short act afterwards. But, you know, right the whole way through, there's this constant conversation between number 10 and 11 about when Tony's going to step down. And, you know, I thought presumably is one of the advantages of doing this contemporary history thing, is you get stuff that seems settled now, you forget is sort of so contested at the time.
It was. And, you know, and opinions are still divided, even among the Blairites, as to whether Tony Blair did the right thing in keeping Gordon Brown on all that time. I mean, at the time, it certainly seemed as if Gordon Brown was a break on what Tony Blair once called an eye-wateringly new Labour government could achieve. But it's more complicated than that, and you know, there's quite a lot of testimony in there from not just Ed Balls, but also Alistair Campbell, saying that, you know, it's not obvious that sacking Gordon Brown would have been the right thing to do, and that actually having Gordon Brown, difficult and rude as he was, may have contributed to better policy outcomes.
How close did he come to getting rid of Brown?
That's a very difficult question to answer, because you know, I mean, if you read Alistair Campbell's diaries, there comes a point, I think, in early 2003 when Tony Blair says, "I've decided he's got to go. I've had enough of this." But he never did it, and the reason he never did it, and he's quite honest about this in his memoirs, is that, you know, Blair thought that he would last longer as Prime Minister if he kept Gordon in than if he got rid of him, because he thought that, you know, if once Gordon was out, then the parliamentary party would become much harder to manage, and, you know, there would be a coup against him.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
One of the things Blair is sort of remembered and credited with is maybe the wrong phrase, but he's seen as someone who sort of completely rethought how to do not just politics, but government too, with a kind of very presidential style. The accusation, at least, is very presidential style to the job, and also kind of very informal approach to decision making, where his special advisors were kind of more important than the civil servants and so on.
Yeah.
What's your view on that? I mean, do you think that's an accurate characterization? Do you think that's a positive or a negative development?
Well, I mean, to the extent it's accurate, it's positive, but it's mostly inaccurate. I mean, the idea of sofa government is something that emerged out of the various inquiries into the Iraq war. But they're all those criticisms are just ways of saying that that someone doesn't agree with the outcomes. I mean, you know, the idea that, you know, that Britain would have held back from joining the Iraq invasion if there had been more sort of committees and civil service papers presented is just for the birds. Generally, Tony Blair ran a completely conventional government, made proper use of cabinet committees and all the rest of it. Obviously, he used them less than some of his predecessors, and less than some civil servants would have liked. I mean, because civil servants wanted to have more influence. But actually, if you look at what's happened since, the number of special advisors has continued to rise, and you could say that, you know, David Cameron was constrained by the coalition, but otherwise ran, you know, a very Blairite government.
Do you think there's a correlation between sort of historically significant or important prime ministers and a sort of tendency to be less collegiate and committee oriented in your approach?
Yes, I mean obviously because the historically significant prime ministers tend to be strong ones, mm-hmm. And they tend to be strong if they have a majority in Parliament. And you know, the single most important fact of the Blair government was that he had an absolutely huge majority for most of his time as Prime Minister. And you know, obviously that has implications for the way you run government. I mean, you know, cabinet government is often something that Prime Ministers have to resort to when they're weak, because they need to get the consent of other cabinet ministers. But Tony Blair was not in that position. He was in a slightly different position in that he was surprisingly weak in relation to Gordon Brown, but not in relation to Parliament. So he had a completely different set of relationships to manage.
And of course, he's very interested in the book in this description of his how he felt, how powerful he felt throughout his time in Number 10, and how at his most unpopular,
yes.
I mean, even though he'd won a majority, but at his most unpopular after 2005, I think there's this great, I don't have it in front of me, but this great line in the book from him about how sort of omnipotent and kind of ready and willing to do anything,
yeah.
with the machinery of government that he wanted to.
Yes, he'd become much more confident in his judgment and his understanding of how to use the machinery of government. But of course, by then the sort of politics were closing in on him, in that, you know, his party had had enough of him. They'd had enough of winning elections, and they wanted to go back into opposition. And you know, once politicians have, you know, sort of deep psychological desires to get him back into opposition, then there's very little that even a leader like Tony Blair could do.
Hmm. One of the things I think it's hard to figure out about Tony Blair, and obviously I'd be really interested in your views on this, is, you know, he's remembered as his achievements are remembered as sort of political ones in terms of how he moved the Labour Party, in terms of his ability to sort of triangulate on various issues, and you know, there's this big emphasis on spin and on dealing with the media and Alistair Campbell and so on.
Yeah.
And inevitably, when that's something that is so prominent in his legacy, the question becomes, you know, what was behind all the spin? Was it just presentation, or what was the actual ideological stuff behind it? So if you had to kind of explain Blairism, not as a political project to do with the Labour Party, but as a sort of standalone ideological project, how would you go about doing that?
Oh, well, I don't think it's that complicated. I think he's a mainstream social democrat. I think a lot of his presentation as a social conservative, as a centrist, And as someone who understood, you know, had a deep understanding of the sort of Daily Mail, Middle England type voter, that was all, you know, managing a basically centre-left government, which was quite successful in achieving traditional social democratic aims, such as, public services and high employment, better education, and all the rest of it.
Mm. Although, I mean, this is probably from him appearing at one of your events at King's, but he there's a bit where he's talking about his view of sort of empowering individuals and so on, which it sort of, it really stuck out to me. It sort of certainly felt to the right of Theresa May, for example. I mean, it did feel very kind of Cameroonian and very, individuals first and centre-right rather than centre-left. But, I mean,
there was quite a lot of that rhetoric, but if you actually look at what he achieved, I think the sort of lasting achievements, and, you know, even they may not have lasted that much, but, I mean, the sort of consistent attempt to raise standards in education, mm-hmm. to expand university education, and to put resources into the NHS. I mean, I think that is all quite sort of left of centre in its long term assessment. But I mean, that doesn't mean that. I mean, you know, he did pursue quite a lot of sort of radical quasi market solutions in all those public services that the left really didn't like, but the goal was certainly a social democratic one, I think.
How much do you think the sort of way we think about Tony Blair now is, you know, you mentioned that the sort of party had enough of winning elections, and there was this sort of exercising of demons, more so when Ed Miliband was leader of the Labour Party, but a bit under Gordon Brown too, and I wonder what your view is on whether the people involved in that sort of regret the extent to which they split from New Labour. I mean,
well, they did
the
way
in which
they,
and the way in which it's the direction the party's gone in as a result. I mean,
Tom Watson, who did all he could to bring Tony Blair down, is now, you know, the hero of the Blairite resistance, and, you know, Neil Kinnock, who celebrated getting his party back, is, you know, by his side. I mean, you know, what's extraordinary is the way in which the sort of Corbynite takeover has forced Blairites and Brownites who really were, I mean, there was a big ideological divide between them, but that's been completely eclipsed by the ideological divide between them and the Marxist leadership of the party now. I mean, it sounds as if I'm being rhetorical, but I mean, they are Marxists.
Yeah.
I mean, they actually believe in. I mean, they're not members of Trotskyist organizations, but I mean,
or at least not at the moment. But well, some of them have been.
Some of them have been, I mean, you know, and there were ex-communists in Tony Blair's government, such as and Alan Milburn was probably some kind of trot a long time ago, and John Reid was an actual member of the Communist Party. But I mean, you know, Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell are very different.
Let's talk. We've sort of skirted around it a bit, but I feel like we need to talk about Iraq a little bit more than we have, just because it was such a significant thing. To explain sort of what you view the mistake. What's the best way to understand the mistake that was?
Well,
because I mean, you do think it was a mistake.
But my view has changed on that. I mean, because for a long time I thought it was. I mean, I supported it at the time. I thought it was justified, and for a long time I thought it was justified on the basis of the information at the time. But I mean, I think having taught the course, having read the Chilcot report, which is a huge piece of work, I think the one thing that I have changed my mind on, do have to accept, is that, you know, it was foreseeable and should have been foreseen that Iraq would descend into sectarian chaos if you removed Saddam Hussein. And, you know, that wasn't obvious at the time, but it's something that should have occurred to Tony Blair and others, and should have given them more pause for thought. I mean, But that is in a way a sort of very much a second order criticism, because, you know, that the decision at the time, the you know, the worst case scenario that Tony Blair was considering at the time was the problem of weapons of mass destruction and, you know, non-state actors like Al-Qaeda coming together. And he was rightly worried about not doing anything to forestall that that threat.
But do you think he went about sort of assessing the evidence of that in a excessively uncritical way? I mean, that's one of the, you know, he, in terms of the intelligence he was given, and he was looking for an answer he wanted to find.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, but that is looking at it through the wrong end of the telescope. I mean, at the time, everyone thought that Saddam Hussein was trying to acquire, you know, some quite nasty weapons, and they thought that he was a threat and a menace to his own people and to the world. And, you know, that was a perfectly reasonable view. Where I think the Chilcot report is right is in saying that, you know, all that may have been true, but would removing Saddam Hussein have made matters better or worse? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Tony Blair, for, you know, completely understandable reasons, you know, a historian can explain them all, thought that it was fairly obvious that just getting rid of a bad man would produce good outcomes. Mm-hmm. But that was a naive belief.
Mm-hmm. Another part of the calculus is that you explain is the fact that America was sort of going to do this anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a sort of, you're not even sort of dealing with the pure question of should we do X, but it's should Britain be involved in doing X?
Exactly. Really, and that's part of why so much of the anger against Tony Blair is so mistaken, because, I mean, a lot of the Labour Party now regards Tony Blair as the sole author of the Iraq War, which is completely to overlook the fact that it all would have happened anyway. You know, obviously, it was terrible that so many people died in the chaos that followed. But that was all going to happen anyway. I mean, that's not an excuse, but it's just to point out that, you know, hating Tony Blair for the death of, you know, so many Iraqis doesn't make sense.
And then there's also the one of the lesser things Iraq's done is it's sort of overshadowed other foreign policy achievements of Tony Blair. I mean, you would say that the foreign policy record of his sort of stands up quite well if you park the Iraq thing. I mean, you obviously can't park the Iraq thing,
no,
but if you
can't.
Look past it. And
but,
look at it.
Yes, I mean, before Iraq, Kosovo and Sierra Leone were huge humanitarian achievements. Huge in once. I mean, they weren't, you know, Sierra Leone is a very small country. But, you know, in both Kosovo and Sierra Leone, Tony Blair is a hero, and rightly so, because you know, he actually marshalled the international community to do something about some really quite nasty, oppressive tyrants.
And of course, the prospect of, well, not even just a Labour government, but sort of any British government doing some stuff like that. I mean, we obviously are involved in Syria and so on, but, you know, one of the downsides of Iraq is surely that it's just this massive scar on our souls in terms of making decisions about foreign policy in the future.
Yeah, and we saw that in Syria, although Syria wasn't a clear-cut case at all.
Yeah.
I fully accept that. But it does, yes, it is a problem in that it has made the use of force for potentially, you know, humanitarian causes that much more difficult.
Hmm. Well, let's look forward now and talk about just briefly about Labour versus the independent group, the new group of MPs, and if you're a sort of ambitious young social democrat who was, you know, listening to this podcast and thinking of becoming an MP and, you know, being prime minister for 10 years and reforming public services, Tony Blair 2.0, are you? Just a sort of analytical question. I mean, is the Labour Party worth bothering with for someone like that, or is it sort of dead as a centre-left institution?
No, I think if Tony Blair were, 1920 now, he would be in the Labour Party, and he'd be trying to, you know, maneuver to take advantage of whatever happens after Corbyn is leader. Because I do think the Corbyn phenomenon depends so much on the personality of Jeremy Corbyn himself as leader. And once he stops being leader, which he will do at some point, you know, I think things will change. And I think, you know, the Labour Party will probably be the vehicle for, you know, the kind of politics that Tony Blair once stood for. At some point, I mean, it seems like quite a long way away.
Yeah,
but I mean, it was when Tony Blair started.
He was elected in 1984.
That's 1983.
So 1983. Sorry, yeah. So
he was, and the party was in a terrible state then. It seemed to be, maybe further away from government than Jeremy Corbyn's party seems. Because I mean, at least Jeremy Corbyn did quite well in the last election against all expectations. So. You know, I think Tony Blair would be in the Labour Party. He would be, you know, obviously interested in the independent group, but you know, I mean, history is against the independent group, and it is almost as if it's sort of replaying the whole SDP breakaway Labour modernisation story all over again. It's not going to be exactly the same, but I think the broad outlines could well be similar.
The obvious rebuttal would be the. Just the membership of the Labour Party is so, it's yes. transformed so much over the last few years that
it has. But I mean, you know, that means it can transform again. That means, you know, these people can learn, can realise that actually the Corbyn project isn't going anywhere, and you know, they will have to learn some of the lessons from history, which is that, you know, unless you can get people who read the Daily Mail to vote Labour, you're not going to form a government.
Well, John Rentoul, that seems like a good piece of advice to end things on. So,
well, on the Daily Mail, terrible place to end. There you go. But the principle stands.
Okay, John Rentoul, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
That was John Rentoul on Tony Blair. Thanks for listening.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.